Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Richard Silverstein, publisher of Tikkun Olam, a blog focusing on Israeli national security issues, who discusses reports that the Biden administration will impose sanctions on an Israeli military unit for human rights abuses. Yale University student hunger strikers and occupiers who are demanding Yale divestment from companies providing weapons to Israel. And Kylie Price, a reporter with Inside Climate News, who talks about the significance of a ruling by Europe's highest human rights court, finding that governments are legally obligated to take action to address the climate crisis. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For many Venezuelan refugees seeking asylum in the United States, getting through Mexico is the toughest obstacle. Migrants fleeing the economic and political crisis in Venezuela face months of delays to get an official immigration interview appointment in the U.S. via an online phone app. Asylum seekers must also deal with corrupt Mexican officials and police roundups that push migrants south toward the Guatemala border. Arrests of migrants for illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexico border have dropped this year after a record high in December. The biggest decline was among Venezuelans, whose arrests plummeted to over 3,000 in February and 4,000 in January from more than 49,000 in December. But thousands of Venezuelans now waiting in Mexico for a U.S. asylum interview feel threatened by gangs who kidnap, extort, and commit other violent crimes. At the urging of the Biden administration, Mexico has cracked down on migrants traveling to the U.S. from Central and South America. The Christian Science Monitor reports that the development highlights how much the U.S. depends on Mexico to control migration, which has reached unprecedented levels and is a top issue for many voters as President Joe Biden seeks re-election. Meanwhile, Donald Trump and his Republican Party allies falsely claim migrants are responsible for a violent crime wave across the U.S. ProPublica reports Chevron agreed to pay $13 million to two California state agencies for past inland oil spills, including a spill still running 21 years after it began in a Kern County oil field. The total amount of oil leaked from these spills exceeded that which was spilled in the 1989 Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska. A ProPublica and Desert Sun newspaper investigation found Chevron and other oil companies profited from these illegal surface spills by scooping up and selling the recovered oil. The oil sold generated $11.6 million over 3 years. The investigation also exposed California's weak regulation of the oil and gas industry. The California Department of Conservation previously identified 378 abandoned oil wells that need to be permanently sealed and cleaned up, while the State Department of Fisheries and Wildlife will use $6.8 million in fines for its Environmental Enhancement Fund, which provides grants for projects that acquire habitat or improve habitat quality and ecosystem function. Whistleblowers from within aircraft manufacturing giant Boeing dominated headlines on Capitol Hill as the company was on the hot seat for accidents, such as the door plug that blew out during an Alaska Airlines flight in January. Previously, 346 people lost their lives in crashes in Ethiopia and Indonesia in 2018 and 2019 when faulty sensors triggered an automated system in Boeing's 737 MAX jet. Congress is now investigating the overall management culture at Boeing, which, according to whistleblowers, prioritized the production schedule over aircraft safety. During an interview with Lester Holt of NBC News, a former quality control engineer insisted there are dangerous gaps between parts of the fuselage of Boeing's 787 Dreamliner. He called for the entire fleet to be grounded and inspected to check the gaps and make sure there is no potential for failure. Amid the crisis and confidence at Boeing, the first new union contract talks with the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers in 16 years is starting up in Seattle. The union is proposing a 3-year contract with wage increases of more than 40%, an end to mandatory weekend overtime, and shortening the length of time it takes for a worker to progress from new hire to the top of the pay scale. And in light of the disastrous series of recent Boeing aircraft accidents, the union is calling for more quality inspectors and more union input into quality control policies. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As the world held its collective breath, Israel and Iran appeared to have averted a deadly all-out war that could have spread across the Middle East and would have likely drawn in world powers, including the U.S. After Israel bombed Iran's Syrian embassy compound on April 1st, killing 7 Iranian military officers, Iran retaliated by launching more than 300 drones and missiles at Israel that did little damage due to effective air defense systems. Israel then hit back with an airstrike that damaged Iran's air defense system in Isfahan province, which guards the nation's underground Natanz nuclear enrichment facility. Tehran played down the incident and indicated it had no plans to retaliate further. Meanwhile, the death toll from Israel's war in Gaza continued to climb to more than 34,000, with the majority of victims women and children. On April 22nd, Palestinian officials say they found mass graves with more than 200 bodies at the sites of Gaza's Al-Shifa and Nasser hospitals following Israeli military operations there. The UN Human Rights Office is investigating. Here in the U.S., the House of Representatives approved $26 billion for Israel and humanitarian aid for civilians in conflict zones, including Gaza. But one day later, it was reported that the Biden administration is considering imposing sanctions on one or more Israeli military units accused of human rights violations during operations in the occupied West Bank. If carried out, this would be the first time Washington has ever imposed sanctions on the Israeli Defense Force. Your reporter spoke with Richard Silverstein, publisher of Tikkun Olam, a blog focusing on Israeli national security issues. Here he discusses the reported U.S. sanctions on Israel and growing concern about the loss of life that will occur if Israel moves forward with its planned attack on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where some 1.5 million Palestinians have sought refuge.
The State Department is about to issue sanctions against an entire IDF brigade called Netzah Yisrael. It's made up of Hilltop Youth, who are the most extreme and violent of the settlers in the West Bank. And they basically put terrorists in uniform and gave them guns. And as a result, they murdered an 80-year-old Palestinian-American citizen in the West Bank, and they've committed other war crimes. And this is the first time that the U.S. has targeted an official government entity. It's the first time that it's targeting the army as well. This is a precedent, I think, that could be expanded in the future, because there are a number of egregious units in the IDF that are known for their brutality, among them the Israeli Border Police, who are very active in suppressing the Palestinians in the West Bank.
Richard, with the ongoing bloody war in Gaza and little indication that negotiations on achieving a ceasefire, Israel is moving forward with what could be a devastating attack on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where 1.5 million Palestinian refugees have sought safety with nowhere else to go. The Biden administration has urged Israel not to go forward with this attack And human rights staff on the ground predict thousands or more casualties of Palestinian civilians if Israel does indeed move forward with its planned attack on Rafah. This seems to be an inflection point of how much influence Joe Biden as president of the U.S. has on Israel and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
I think that we have very limited influence on Netanyahu because of two things. First of all, Netanyahu has an extremist fascist government whose ministers are prepared not only to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from all of Palestine, but also to engage in genocide. Netanyahu has to keep his far-right wing satisfied, and Biden is completely out of that realm. So Netanyahu actually will score points in Israel by defying the United States. And Biden, who could exert a lot of impact and influence on the Israelis, refuses because of him being under the thumb and under the influence of the Israel lobby here in the United States. So he's engaged in some small, tepid actions after three vetoes of the UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. We finally changed our tune, and I think we abstained from the vote, but that allowed it to be passed. So we've had lost opportunities all along the way here. And Biden is desperate for this to be contained because he's got an election in November. And there's a huge disgruntled minority in the Democratic Party. I would say close to 1 million Democrats in primaries have voted uncommitted instead of voting for him. So many of that million or so those votes are going to return to him in November. But even if a small percentage don't, we have an election that's going to be on the razor's edge in terms of, you know, Trump and Biden. And, you know, even 1,000 votes here or there in different states could turn the outcome of the election. And Biden, in my opinion, has really squandered a political opportunity and really endangered his chances of being reelected in November. And if I can just pivot to a different but related issue, and that is that next month, the International Criminal Court is probably going to issue arrest warrants for a genocide investigation that it has been conducting since 2014. The chief prosecutor is expected to issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu and the senior military command. That would limit their ability to leave Israel. And if they did go to countries that are signatories to the Rome Statute, which created the ICC, they could be arrested and conveyed to The Hague for trial. So this is also an unprecedented development, and it's directly tied to Gaza. And if they invade Rafah, going back to your question, then the ICC becomes even more potent in terms of expressing global outrage. And the ICC has never gone further than announcing an investigation of Israel. This would take it one step farther and could lead to an indictment, could lead to a trial, could lead to a conviction. And these are very positive developments.
That was Richard Silverstein, publisher of Tikkun Olam, a blog focusing on Israeli national security issues. Learn more about possible U.S. sanctions against an Israeli military unit and additional analysis on the continuing war in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Joining campus actions across the U.S., protesting the mass slaughter of Palestinian civilians in Gaza, Yale University students began a hunger strike and peaceful campus occupation in mid-April with the demand that the Yale Corporation disclose its investments in companies providing weapons to Israel in its war on Gaza and then divest from them. Students occupied Beinecke Plaza, site of many past campus political protests, such as the 1986 shantytown erected to call for the university's divestment from corporations invested in apartheid South Africa. As hunger strikers rested under a canopy, Students held teach-ins, and the faithful responded to the call to Muslim prayers. The Yale Corporation met on April 20th, but made no announcement that it had even considered the students' demands. 2 days later, early on the morning of April 22nd, campus police raided the plaza while most were still sleeping and arrested 47 people, almost all students. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with several of those protesting at Yale, including one of the 14 hunger strikers, some of whom were then on their seventh day of fasting.
We had released a statement on our Instagram page at Yale Hunger Strike that we will continue to hunger strike until we receive a direct response from President Peter Salovey and the Board of Trustees, who can choose to not heed this recommendation from the advisory committee, right? Because the advisory committee has said that the investment in authorized arms manufacturing does not qualify for grave social injury, which is the condition of divestment. However, of course, we are insisting that given this genocide, right, of course it constitutes grave social injury. And just because the U.S. is authorizing, you know, arms manufacturing that directly feeds into the genocidal assault on Palestine currently doesn't make it any less of a grave social injury, right? Part of this is so that our voice would be heard by Yale, but also many of us are not doing this for Yale so much as we are humbling ourselves before Palestinian people in struggles for liberation. And I would say that we have also seen a lot of student and faculty support of the occupation of Beinecke Plaza, and of course also of the hunger strikers who are also sitting at Beinecke Plaza. Of course, many of them have participated in teach-ins, and many have come by to drop off COVID tests, masks, Pedialytes, flowers. Yeah, there's been an overwhelming amount of love that I think has also been an affirmation in our shared political commitments. And we all hope that by being here and by channeling the memory of all of those who have come before us in organizing in struggles for liberation, that we can also convince the institution to divest.
After Beinecke Plaza was cleared on April 22nd, students and community supporters immediately took over an intersection of two New Haven streets through campus and remained there until late afternoon. Zachary Herring is a recent Yale grad and a member of Jewish Voice for Peace.
Why is this educational institution invested in war? They won't disclose, you know, these details, but they're not denying it. And so I think they're saying, like, disclose the details and divest. Divest from this war.
Several speakers condemned Yale administrators' claims that the totally peaceful student occupation was violent and that some New Haven residents with a history of committing violence had taken control of the action, for which at least one administrator later apologized. Late in the day, a faculty supporter of the students, who wished to remain anonymous, spoke to the hundreds of people who had occupied the intersection all day.
While this administration sees fit to arrest our students, we as classroom leaders can model for them a different kind of leadership based on critical care and compassion. As the students' chants continue to resound, books not bombs.
Then, after negotiating with the New Haven Police Department, student leaders agreed to vacate the intersection at rush hour and moved their planned Seder and Muslim prayers to a site on campus. There were no additional arrests. The hunger strikers ended their strike after 8 days.
This is our city, and we want to respect that. And also, the target of what we're doing is not New Haven, it's Yale.
Those were voices of Yale University students engaged in a hunger strike and occupation, calling for Yale to divest from companies providing weapons to Israel. Learn more about the Yale protest actions and other students mobilizing across the U.S. against Israel's slaughter of Palestinian civilians in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a landmark decision on April 9th, the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, ruled that the government of Switzerland had violated their citizens' human rights by not taking sufficient action to address the climate crisis, a verdict that many legal observers say could influence other courts to look favorably on similar future lawsuits. The case was brought by a group based in Switzerland called Senior Women for Climate Protection, 2,000 women aged 64 and up, who argued that inaction by the Swiss government put their health at risk during increasingly more frequent heat waves that climate science attributes to global warming. Europe's highest human rights court agreed, declaring that Switzerland had failed to meet its target to reduce carbon emissions and must act to address that failure. This is the first case where an international court has determined that governments are legally obligated to meet their carbon emission reduction goals under human rights law. The European Court didn't provide specific instructions on the policies to be implemented, but left it to the Swiss government to comply, following its democratic process. Your reporter spoke with Kylie Price, a reporter with the online publication Inside Climate News, who provides an overview of the significance of this case, covered in her recent article titled, "A Group of Women Took Switzerland to Court Over Climate Inaction and Won."
In 2020, a group of women aged 64 and up filed a lawsuit before Europe's top human rights court against Switzerland for violating their rights by not protecting them from the health impacts of climate change. So each of these women were part of a group which in English is called Senior Women for Climate Protection. And more specifically, they alleged that Swiss authorities were not taking sufficient action despite their duties under the European Convention on Human Rights, which the court says legally guarantees people the, quote, effective protection by the state authorities from the serious adverse effects of climate change. So on April 9th of this year, so that's 4 years later from when the case was originally filed in front of this top human rights court, the court decided in the women's favor, which marked the first time an international court has ruled on governments' legal obligations regarding climate change. So it's a pretty landmark case. It's gotten a lot of buzz, and I think people are waiting to see how it plays out in the rest of the world. But I think what was really striking about it is that there were basically 17 judges from different countries and perspectives and legal backgrounds, but it was a near unanimous decision in this scenario.
This verdict, what action does it authorize in terms of mitigating climate change or enforcing the rules or pledges nations make? Switzerland, of course, most relevant to this case. What does this verdict mean for people in Europe or Switzerland here?
Yeah, so the court didn't go as far as to say exactly what Switzerland had to do to mitigate the situation. But kind of jumping back to what they found read like Switzerland not fulfilling its climate commitments, more specifically, the country didn't fulfill its pledge to cut its greenhouse gas emissions by 20% by 2020 compared with 1990 levels. So instead, they found that Switzerland reduced emissions by around just 11% between 2013 and 2020. So they didn't fulfill this pledge that they publicly made. The court also found that they hadn't set what's called a national carbon budget, which basically puts a cap on how much carbon dioxide can be emitted by industry, homes, and the economy throughout the country. So that's kind of the background of how they came to the conclusion they did. But without going as far as to say specific actions they had to take, the court instead leaves Switzerland to determine its own measures to remedy this in their country. But that's going to be under the supervision of a committee of government representatives from member states. So basically, if Switzerland doesn't update its policies, experts are saying that future litigation could follow up at a national level, and potentially even financial penalties could follow if they don't do this.
So really, it lays a legal foundation for future litigation is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, pretty much. And so kind of jumping ahead, I know that this case was technically against Switzerland, but given that it was at Europe's top human rights court, it actually binds other European countries as well. So it has pretty far-reaching impacts, most directly for Europe, meaning that if nations don't align their climate plans with the science-based targets included in the Paris Agreement, which was decided in 2015, they could face similar litigation that Switzerland has faced in national courts and international courts. So experts are saying there's going to be probably influence in other courts far-reaching across the world. You might remember back in 2022, in the summer, there were a series of heat waves in Europe that just absolutely impacted almost every country across Europe, and it killed more than 61,000 people in Europe, and the majority of them were women over 80 years old. So in this case, the Swiss women argued that their age and gender made them particularly vulnerable to such climate change impacts. And there's data to back this up. In Switzerland specifically, more than 60% of the 600-ish heat-related deaths in 2022 were attributed to global warming. And that's interesting here because attribution science is essentially a form of science that tries to link things or not link things. And that's where it's difficult with climate change court cases to be able to definitively make a link to climate change and some sort of extreme weather event like a heat wave. But in this case, the court did rule that Switzerland was putting these women who are a bit older at risk, and heat waves was just one example of that.
That was Kylie Price, a reporter with the online publication Inside Climate News. Find a link to her article titled, "A Group of Women Took Switzerland to Court Over Climate Inaction and Won," and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KCBP in Wesley, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.